Good morning, and thank you for having me here, Sunil, and your team. So the brief that I've been given is to do a broad outline of the kinds of issues that will come up today, and to introduce it in, I think, more academic terms than necessarily activist terms. So I pose what I think are interesting questions. I don't feel the need at this point to take positions on everything and so on. So that's my job, and I think I have 20 minutes. Is that how you time me? 20 minutes to the speaker. Okay. What I've just tentatively titled what I hope will be a paper in the making, Software Patents, Problems of Principle and Policy. I make the distinction between principle and policy not because I think it's some hard-nailed distinction that we should stick to, because it's just that I've tried to survey in preparation for this presentation the kinds of arguments that are being made by respondents to the draft manual, whether that be the Free Software Foundation, ALF, Knowledge Commons. And I think that the arguments seem to split along these lines, and so I'll just choose this division between principle and policy. I'll start with the principled arguments for or against, or the principles that one must keep in mind when you think and talk about software patents. So to do the preliminaries, Patents Act 1970, amendment rules in 2005, those together form the primary and the delegated legislation around patent law in India. The three amendments, the three staged amendments of the Indian Patent Act for compliance with TRIPS, of course, and now the draft manual of patent practice. So the first question that lawyers would ask is, what is the relationship between these varied forms of lawmaking? How do they stand in relation to each other? I think this is an important point because the public consultation focuses on one species. We're not talking about software patents generally, we are, but we are also talking about the draft patent manual, which is the immediate cause for concern. So some typology of types of lawmaking is important. And I think what's elementary and is grasped by all participants in the debate certainly is that these forms of lawmaking are organized in a hierarchy with the Patents Act, that's parliamentary legislation, has the highest priority, rules that follow, and the draft manual, a patent practice manual, being a third in the hierarchy. So if for any reason inconsistency can be shown between a practice manual and the rules, or the practice manual and the Act, the practice manual will have to give way. This is also made clear in the first, I think, sentence, or the first paragraph of the practice manual. Just by way, as a moonlighting practitioner who does IP law, what I can tell you is that very often, even a very junior officer in the IP offices, trademark patent offices, will tell you that if you cite the patent, the trademark manual to them, they'll force you in proceedings to argue from first principles based on the Act. So it's not like they say, okay, if you cite me the patent manual, then I'll just pass your objections. That's the first point about just the hierarchy and typology of laws. So while we must be concerned about the patent manual, we must be clear that in most litigation and most jurisprudence that will develop, the patent manual will occupy a subordinate status, and in very many cases will not be followed. I think that's an important thing, and it ties up with what I think are good strategies and my conclusions in this paper. But I hope that this typology of different kinds of patent laws or patent rules is kept in mind throughout the day. I think it's relevant because lots of arguments will be made about the Patent Act as it stands and the patent rules as they stand, and the manual. And keeping this distinction in mind is important. Okay, so we are concerned primarily with Section 3K as an exclusion to patentable subject matter. So the second part of my talk focuses on the nature of the exclusion. What kind of an exclusion is Section 3K? Now, the way I see it is that patent law operates in a general with a general principle that's captured in the TRIPS agreement, which goes that patenting is allowed in all fields of technology. Now, is that a good principle? That's a wider debate, but that's certainly a legal rule to which we have signed up to in agreement. Does the Indian Patent Act have a similar approach? Does it say patenting in all fields of technology? It doesn't say it. It doesn't say it expressly. In fact, it seems to hedge around that question a little bit. But what does technological neutrality require in a patent law? Has been an issue of some debate, especially in the area of drugs. So far, the debate has primarily been in the area of drugs. Why? Because several countries have adopted a differential standard for drug patents, and so the question has been asked, does this violate the technological neutrality requirement? And for those of you who are familiar, the Canada Bollard patent exemption case and so on, the international position on this is quite nuanced. It seems to run against the grain of the text because it allows for variable standards in different fields of technology. I guess the difficult part would be to say we won't patent something. And the TRIPS agreement seems to give that rope only for the issue of life. That life forms may not be patentable seems to be an accepted exclusion. Everywhere else, you can't be categorical in exclusions. You can hedge around that question a little bit. And we know that in the area of patents, we do. So the question I ask myself first, with Section 3K, is what kind of an exclusion is Section 3K? Is it an exclusion of principle, by which I mean an exclusion based on a patent law principle accepted in almost all jurisdictions, which is that patents should be granted not over abstract ideas, but over worked inventions? That's what is patentable is a worked invention. It must be shown to be applied in some field and capable of application. I think that's the phrasing that most lawyers use. Industrial application is used occasionally, but that's not very important for me. But that is a general principle accepted in patent law all over the world, including in India. But in the Indian Act, which draws on the British tradition, this is not stated expressly. In the American Act, by contrast, the American law on the subject, this first principle is stated expressly. You will only get protection for worked inventions, not for abstract ideas. Okay? So if we just keep this this general principle in mind, then we can ask, is Section 3K another, given that our Patent Act doesn't have a general exclusion of abstract ideas, is Section 3K an expression that captures this general idea, right? So if you run through Section 3, this is how I would break it up, and this is how I teach this subject. I say there are two kinds of exclusions. There's one, the kind of exclusion like Section 3D of the Patent Act as it stands now, which is a very specific exclusion for patents relating to drugs. And it says, in the case of drugs, we will require an enhanced efficacy standard. An efficacy standard that may not be required, say, of music systems. When we judge inventiveness or patentability generally with respect to drugs, we will expect enhanced efficacy. But not in the case of sound systems. And you might ask, why do you have this exclusion? Is this an exclusion of profound principle? It is not. It's an exclusion of policy. We just have decided that drugs are too important an area to allow for excessive patenting. So we put an efficacy standard in. Okay? So this kind of policy-based exception, why do we not allow patenting of life? Is it that patent law cannot work life? No, it can. We can apply the very same standards to life forms and have a robust patent law. There's nothing in patent law that makes life non-patentable. It's just that you've made a policy decision, that is a normative decision based on other considerations, that you will not patent life. life forms. And once you made that policy decision, you put it into the act. The other kind of exclusion in section 3 is what I call exclusions of principle, which is that they are enunciations of the general principle in patent law that protection will only be given to worked inventions. Now, when one reads section 3K and look at the genus in which computers per se is nested, you find that it seems to exclude what? Abstract ideas. It seems to. But a lot of the arguments that are being made, both by policy advocates and others, are really treating the computers per se exception as being a policy exception. That is, that it's not good to have patent law operate in the field of computer software because of certain reasons. Reasons of political economy, reasons of the nature of computer software as a technological field, so on and so forth. But it seems to me that the stronger wicket to bat on is to argue that it's a principled exclusion and it should remain as that. What kinds of arguments of policy are taken up? Okay, so I'll just close with this. The arguments of policy are well rehearsed, and I feel less of a burden to carry that weight, because the argument is made in terms of the unique nature of software as code, the source code, object code kind of arguments. It's also made about the unique nature of innovation in the software industry, incremental versus foundational innovation and so on, or what's called the blockbuster, the absence of the blockbuster in software innovation. It's also made in terms of software economics, that's development versus manufacturing costs and so on. But I think that policy argument has been well worked for over 15 years in the international debate. And I think the Indian advocacy positions that I familiarized myself with in the last few days seem to use that in an effective sort of way. Okay, but what I see being different is that policy arguments in India can broadly be divided, and this is I think the second part of my paper, maybe the third, into two types. They're national interest arguments, and there seem to be public interest arguments. I make this distinction, I think it's an important one. National interest arguments are the staple of Indian patent law. So for those of us who teach this and go through the committee reports, the various committee reports that form the background history to patent law in India, we know this national interest argument very well. Let us take the Iyengar committee report, for example. As a standard three-step analysis that the Iyengar committee report does, it seems to focus very heavily on two fields, on pharmaceuticals and agricultural chemicals. It doesn't focus that much, it doesn't focus on software, but doesn't focus on other fields. And what kinds of questions does it ask? It asks a few questions that go like this. Who files the patents? It asks the nationality question, the nationality of patent holders. Second, what is the capacity of domestic industry to compete? Third, what is the impact of patents on the domestic industry? This is the substance of the analysis in the Iyengar committee report. And it marshals data in these two fields, in the fields of drugs and in the fields of agricultural chemicals, to argue that this evaluation will show that patents would have an adverse impact on the national interest, right? And my sense is that some of the objections, I think a couple of them, have picked up on this train of argument and have tried to make the same argument with respect to software, which is that if we allow software patents, it will adversely impact national domestic IT industry. I'm not very familiar with, I don't know if there have been any academic studies to support this claim. Most of the references in the advocacy pieces are all to, there are either no references at all, or there are references to foreign sources. So I'm curious, maybe this claim is a sustainable one, that patents will do bad things to Indian domestic industry, but I'm I'm just saying that. Let me stick my head out and say, I think we need to still make it. And we need to make it with more careful data and analysis. My sense of the existing literature is that it's weaker on this ground. But maybe I think the public interest argument is much stronger. And the reason the public interest argument is much stronger is that it's been well worked out in other jurisdictions with very rigorous economic modeling, the kind of economic modeling that passes policymakers' tests. Okay, what do they look for? How is this public interest argument different? It usually is an argument in economics, or it's an argument. I think I'm just looking at all that I have. There's a minor argument in law, which I'll just come to. So there are two arguments in economics and one argument in law that I see being made repeatedly on the software patents question. The economic arguments go like this. First is the inapplicability of the incentive argument. So the patents are justified as being necessary because they generate incentives for the production of software. The argument is that's already covered by copyright in the case of software. Do you need additional incentives? There is a production of sufficient amount of software. Is there an incentive problem in the field of software? The second argument is usually an argument about return on investment, which is that the return of investment profiles of, let's just take two industries, software and drugs, is so different that in the drugs field, you can make some plausible argument about why patents are necessary to garner the return on investment. But if you look at the short shelf life of computer software products, it's argued that patents play no role. 17-year patent term is irrelevant when the shelf life of the product is 2 to 4 years, and so on. So that's the second argument on the economic side. A third argument is that if you use patents, you will introduce new intermediaries into the software market. Which is, what do you mean by this? Intermediaries who are neither producers nor consumers of software, but intermediaries in the market who assist what is called price discovery. So these are firms which will buy up patents and then sue. Right? They have no intention of producing software or of consuming software. But what they have an interest in doing is exploiting the potential of a patent, right? The value of the property right. So what has happened in the software sector is that you've introduced these new intermediaries into the game by allowing patents, because they're able to discover value in patents that were previously thought, for some reason neglected. Okay, so these are the sorts of public interest arguments that are made against the granting of software patents. It was interesting, and I just close with a minor legal anecdote, which is that when I studied some of these issues for the first time nearly a decade ago, it was argued at that point quite fervently by very established scholars, legal scholars in the field, that the entire area of software was moving from property to contract, which is that legal regulation in this field would move with the establishment of encryption as a very viable technological resource. It would move into contractual modes of regulation. That software vendors would need property less and less. They would not even need copyright. Forget about patent. And I think that, it just seems to me, and thinking about the issues being raised by this consultation, it seems to me that we should ask that question. What role does copyright play? Even to what extent does copyright have a role in the business models of present software vendors? Is the business of software built robustly enough around contract? And I think it's a theoretical argument that's been made and made quite successfully way back in the late 90s, 97, 98. But I think we need to revisit that question. Because if you make a software-specific argument, the software doesn't need these kinds of protections, then I think that the argument is not about, is partly about copyright versus patent, but it's also about contract versus property. Do you need property at all in this field, and what role does it serve? And it seems to me that for my survey of the literature, that this exhausts the public interest arguments that seem to be made. Economics arguments, legal arguments. I'm only talking about the policy wonk kind of argument. I'm not saying that there aren't other more rhetorical and emotive appeals. Fair enough. I'm just ignoring them for the moment. Okay. So what have I done so far? I've covered a couple of issues. I just did the typology of laws. Then I looked at a principle-based argument for software exclusion. Then I look at the policy-based arguments for exclusion of software from patenting. Let me close with a point about strategies. While the discussion today is about the patent manual, I think there is general awareness that software patents have in fact been granted. They've been granted in the US under a particular legal framework. They've been granted in the EU under a different legal framework. And we are aware that in India they've been granted. We're not sure under what legal framework. Right? And this is not about the 2002 amendment. This is not about... I'm talking about way back from 95. And I know that one of my fellow speakers is going to talk about what the patent database reveals about patent grants. So I think the first thing we need to take on board is the idea that if the issue is software patents, the manual is only a part of the problem, that there is a problem of granted software patents already in India. We just need to investigate how much, how many, and I think a very important research question in this regard is to find out how many applications were filed at different points in time. What I'm suggesting is it that the 2002 amendment introducing 3K increased the grant of software patents, or did it have no effect? Maybe the number of applications to the number of grants before 2002 would roughly be the same as the number of applications to the number of grants post-2002. Okay? And we have that amendment, and Prabir just alerted me to the fact that the ordinance was in effect for 6 months. So we must investigate how many patents were granted when the ordinance was in effect. And I think this data is important. It's important for us to understand the relationship, how the patent office, the patent practice around software patents. We need to understand that it's a very important area for research, and I think organizations like ISOC and Pranesh are well placed to do that very important work. So I think that's, in terms of strategies, I think that's an important strategy to start with, capture this data. Second, is the role of pre-grant and post-grant oppositions and revocation proceedings. Now, it's one thing to contest the manual, and with or without success, it's not clear how much of it will change and so on. But it's another to bring pressure on the patent office on its jurisprudence. And I'm suggesting to you that the manual may not result in a spurt of grants. The grants may have started way back in 95. So the challenges to these grants have to be done. Now, I would just analogize very quickly that pre-post-grant opposition and revocation proceedings are analogous to what we do in property law called, mutation of revenue records. And I think the analogy is relevant for two reasons. First, it's not like some mind-blowingly difficult thing to do. Right? It's very gritty work. It's the kind of hard-nosed legal work that will get results. But my sense is that the pharma opposition groups in India have shown the way. And if there is commitment in this community to establishing a patent law jurisprudence around computer software, then the space to do it, the first space to do it, is the patent office. And the best way to take the battle to the patent office is to file opposition, post-grant oppositions for those already granted. And if we are aware of applications pending, to get into the pre-grant opposition space. And I think that good results will flow from there. Thank you.
Before we move on to Prabir, should we take just two questions from the floor? One, the The second one? Two.
Hi, my question is not about your content, I'm sorry. My question is, this is a public meeting, and before any speaker starts, I request that what level of legal and technical expertise they are expecting from the public, from the audience, that will be nice. Just to tell us that I'm going to start at this level, because I'm assuming that a presentation on the principles of patent law would start from the base up. If that's not expected of the audience, they're expected to know a certain level of stuff about the patent law or about the software or the patents. Then if you could alert the audience on that.
I'll just come back.
Maybe you can say something about the effectiveness metric. That's the thing that you said gave an exception to the medical pharma thing, right? I mean, why are we copying somebody else's effectiveness metric? You know, why not the harming way instead of the short-term way?
Mm-hmm. Okay. On the respond?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. On the first question of principles and way up, yes, we've got to have some baseline from which we all start. But my sense of the layout of the presentations is that you'll have a general overview presentation here, and then people attacking specific questions like the definition of 3K, what is novelty, and so on. So I think different speakers are speaking to these issues. So the layout is more or less the policy terrain and what the legal terrain on the subject is, and then different people are going into the specific questions. So that's how I read this. The second thing about efficacy, enhanced efficacy for pharmaceutical patents. So you have an enhanced efficacy test. I didn't get what you meant by standards set elsewhere, because the point of the 3D test is to not apply standards set elsewhere. So the idea is to evolve a different standard with respect to pharma patents. Is that the way to go with software? I didn't say that at all. I don't think a 3D test is what we're looking for. I'm just saying that the battle in software is not about policy arguments.
No, I'm asking about the standardization of the effectiveness itself. What is effectiveness?
Effectiveness in...
That sentence doesn't make sense.
In what sense? In the pharma sense? That's... No, I...
See.
Effectiveness is not a criterion in the standard metric of patent evaluation. We don't... You're not expected to produce the most efficient solution to a problem.
But the patent exception came about because of the more effective or less effective.
We're talking the pharmaceutical case.
Yeah.
Can we sort of leave that out for the time?
No, no.
It's a completely different argument by itself. It's really a separate.
It's the same thing that will come up later. So let's set the base here. If you can answer, you answer. Otherwise, say you don't know or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or you say we'll leave that out, but let him be for a while.
Let me have a last go. If the question is, does the efficacy standard apply to software, the answer is no, categorically. If the question is, should the enhanced efficacy standard apply to software, my answer is no, because the nature of the exclusion of software is a principled exclusion. That is, we don't want abstract ideas being protected. So there's no inquiry into efficacy in the first place. So that's the position that I've taken.
No, my thing was, what is efficacy?
It will be the patent office if the patent office is making the grant.
You can come to this one.